type of law will not be passed because those who most need it are most afraid of it. They are not concerned with making it work. They would be very unhappy if they found that it did work. Because if selfishness can be proven to be a complete failure, we might have a better kind of world to live in. It has proved that it is a failure. But a lot of people are clinging to the hope that they are going to be exceptions to the general condition. That they can do as they please and all will be well, but other people cannot. So here we have the problem that we must shift our allegiance. Now, theology attempted to do this, but unfortunately, theology also settled back onto the level of the mind and the personal claims of people. What should have been the service of deity became a hierarchy on the theological level, which very largely developed ambitions and power complexes and mistook physical wealth for spiritual integrity. Thus, the theological system didn't work well. But it is true, finally, that this universe is a theocracy. But it is a theocracy in which the supreme power is vested not in a regent, but in the law or truth itself. There is a law that holds atoms together. There is a law that perpetuates the species. There is a law that gives us food and air. And there is a law that brings moral life into our families. These rules are the basis of human relationships. When they are obeyed, problems are solved. When they are avoided or corrupted or compromised, problems increase. So sit down sometime by yourself. When you want to do something, when you want to say something, for any act of importance that you make, and try to find out the level from which it comes. See if you can find in your own actions levels of causation that you cannot explain. This may be the very key to the whole matter. If you know where it came from, you may still be in trouble. But if you reach that point, where you know something must be done, but you do not know why, but the determination to do it is the greatest and represents the highest concept of conviction, of integrity that you possess, you're moving in the right direction. So it becomes very important to weed out ulterior motives which disfigure the conduct and character of the person. Now, we have in this philosophical field that concerns us, we have a whole group of beautiful teachings, wonderful ideas, wonderful and constructive notions, but interwoven among them is a very large amount of self-conceit. Instead of being just a pure faith in realities, these various faiths become competitive institutions trying to take memberships away from each other, which has nothing to do with the fact, because the only organization in which a real membership can exist is in the organization of that being which is within and behind the body. In other words, heaven is the only organization that can survive, because it is the only one which is all-inclusive, and therefore in which there can be no conflicts, no jealousies, no competitive careers. Now, as you take this into your own life, if you are concerned with trying to improve your inner life, and I think we all are, certainly we do the best we know how in most cases, but by sitting down carefully and thinking about what we do, we may be able to raise the whole platform of life one step nearer to the being in the body. Something nearer to the universal will of that which is now locked within a cage of particulars. So if you say, I think I should do this, or I think I shouldn't do that, try and find out why. See what level of integrity you're working from. And see if you can find out how to remove from your daily life all or as many as you can of the factors which disfigure the relationship between the being and the body. In other words, everything which is a compromise tightens the prison which locks in the principle of life. If then we say to ourselves, I want to be a religious person, and to be a religious person, I want to have spirituality. I want to have insight, I want to have integrities, I want to have the assurance that I'm on my way to cosmic consciousness or something like it. So we then say to ourselves, why do I want this? Why do I want to know more than I know now? And when you start digging into yourself to find the answer to that question, you may find some other curious circumstances. We may find that under this search for truth, the real fact is ambition. We want to be greater than somebody else. We want to be wiser than somebody else. We want to have influence over other people. We want to gradually expand our knowledge and understanding in the sense that we are going to become members of the higher board of directors and are going to contribute to telling everything else what to do. This type of attitude is there. We see it frequently. We find that the individuals trying to grow puts a barrier in the path of his own growth. He puts the barrier of why he wants to grow. He wants to outdistance something, or he wants to avoid something. I know a number of people who have turned to religion, for example, because they were lonely. Well, something can be said. Maybe it was moved them in that direction. But the life they are seeking, the light they are seeking, is something much higher than the fact that they are isolated or semi-isolated in this world. Everything must move to the fulfillment of that which is the infinite reality. And this infinite reality has no pets, it has no favorites, it has no intention of picking out an ordinary mortal and deifying them for some reason. Everything depends on the motives. If, however, you can go inside of yourself and you can say to yourself honestly and without restriction and without reservation, I want to know more only for one reason, that I can serve others, that I can be more useful. Now then, the moment this comes up, however, the secondary egotism steps in, if you're not very careful, because the process of serving others becomes a form of the fulfillment of an impulse to leadership, which can also get into trouble. We have to try to understand in ourselves why we want to be good. Is it to be comfortable? Is it to be forceful? Is it to improve our material circumstances alone? Or is it because we sincerely want to give full expression to something higher than we've ever known before? If the motives are right, and if our dedication is correct, among the byproducts of it will be many of the things that we think we need. We will find that happiness is a byproduct. You cannot make yourself happy. Happiness is the result of so living that the inner life is at peace. This, consequently, is a byproduct, but it has to be earned. The Arabian Nights entertainment has the line in it, happiness must be earned. And this is very, very true. And to earn it, we must deserve it. And to deserve it, we must have kept the rules by means of which the integrities of life are protected. Otherwise, we cannot be happy. So it comes to many different attitudes. But we have to also then take a careful look at the other side of the coin. A great many people, feeling that it's necessary to grow in some way, decide that the best way to grow is to get away from humanity, to get off by themselves into some community and live uncontaminated existences. This is another obvious failure. There is nothing to be gained by the individual seeking for peace in order to gain his own comfort and liberation. There can be no real peace without solution. The avoider cannot achieve either. It is only the person who works with the problems, stays out there and fights with it, who can bring about within his own nature a strength great enough to be of useful value to the divine plan of things. We cannot run away from unfinished business and consider that a solution. We cannot believe that virtue is to be attained by hiding oneself from vice. It is not that way at all. Virtue is a consciousness which transcends vice, corrects it, and goes on. Anything that is an evasion or an avoidance means that we are closing a channel by which the life in us is supposed to function. Therefore, a full life means that we grow from mistakes, but we benefit from them. Most people lose almost all the value of a mistake because their first thought is to blame somebody else for it. The individual who makes a bad decision considers that he's been over-influenced. The only reason why a person is over-influenced really is because they haven't got the inner life light to influence themselves correctly. So that there is no gain if we transfer the guilt for our misfortunes to society or to other persons or to situations that arise in our environment. The individual must accept full responsibility. The moment he can evade himself out of a problem, its value as a spiritual experience is lost. And we nearly always do it. I think it's one of the most common problems in the world. One, of course, of the reasons for it is that we may accept a level of advice which is inadequate. If we follow persons who do not know, then we are in trouble. And if we try to find answers to our own shortcomings from sources which are inadequate and are not intelligently dominated, we can't get very far. Now, one of the things I think we also have to realize is that a useless life is a waste of divine energy. A useless life is like turning all the lights in the house on and then going away and leaving them on. A useless life is energy expended for no reason. A useless life is waste. And it's often involved in extravagance because the useless individual tries to buy usefulness, tries to find some kind of false entertainment or false pleasures which are usually expensive. Therefore, it is very, very important for the individual to maintain a proper usefulness with life. Every day should be loaded with lessons of some kind. The individual should be better at the end of every day. He should be a little nearer to obeying the law, because all the experiences of his outside living reveal laws every time he turns around. He is constantly in the midst of a network of realities, which he rejects or ignores or tries to misinterpret. So the individual who has this energy within him is not doing it well if he wastes it. And wastes it means to do things that are not useful, not helpful, not purposeful, and not in harmony with truth. Uselessness is to fill empty time to try to be as comfortable as possible till death comes. It is just sitting around doing foolish things and assuming that this is living. As long as a person has the breath of life in themselves, they can labor and learn. They can do something that is significant to the unfoldment of their own inner lives. To waste time is, in a sense, a sin against God. because time is a period set aside for use. And when we waste it, we waste the life power that should have motivated it. And when we use the spiritual energies of life for some trite and useless activity, we are simply failing in the large emergencies of things. So with the Greeks and the Oriental people also, there comes this problem of trying to get into the inside of our own questions and our own problems. Pythagoras advocated a discipline of retrospection for this purpose. He taught that his disciples and everyone who believed in truth should at the end of every day make a very careful analysis of that day and its happenings, usually in reverse order, so that in the problem of meditating or of working with this retrospective exercise, the individual begins with the effect in that day and goes back to the cause. Instead of seeing the causes produce their effects, he sees effects and then that way becomes gradually aware of causes. This is the more important way, according to the Greek consciousness, because it's the effect that we face every day, and it is the cause of the effect that we ignore. So in retrospective exercise, the person takes a good long look at himself. He realizes that he is the pen in the hand of a ready writer. He realizes that he has resources which are intended to perfect him and fulfill him so that he can go on into higher orders of evolutionary existence. That he therefore should study, meditate upon his own conduct. If he finds that he has made a mistake that is correctable, he should correct it. Sometimes a mistake can be corrected if you find it out within a few hours. If you wait for 20 years, it very often cannot be corrected. So you start in and you say, well, I was annoyed. I got angry. I said something very unkind to my child this afternoon. Why? Because I was annoyed. Why was I annoyed? Because, well, someone bothered me when I didn't want to be bothered. And so you trace on back until you find out the cause of the annoyance. You look yourself straight in the face and say, hey, that was pretty foolish. You finally discover that your daily life is a mass of unrelated incidents that are comparatively meaningless. And by the time night comes, you're worn out with your own mistakes. This is necessary. It is perfectly possible for the individual, by carefully watching a day's activity, to find out what he neglected, what he did that was wrong, what he spent that he shouldn't have spent, the kind words he should have spoken but didn't, unkind words that he should not have spoken but did. All these things in a nice, quiet retrospection over a period of 20 or 30 minutes at the end of a day will help the individual to find out how he really lived. And the interesting point about that is this process of retrospection, what is behind it? What would make us do this? Why would we want to know something more about ourselves? Why should we want to correct some mistake? The answer gradually becomes apparent as we do the retrospection, namely that wherever we did that which was not right, the consequences were bad. Whatever we misrepresented hurt us. Whatever we neglected left us less reliant. We became less and less thoughtful because we made no effort to determine the consequences of our own conduct. All of this gradually releases into us a realization of something, namely that there is nothing in this world that we can think, feel, or do that does not have consequences. And these consequences are part of the law, and they relate to the being in the body. It is not the mind that punishes us. It is life that punishes us. It is not the emotion that destroys us because we have misused it. It is because the energy in the emotion was ruled by universal law and we broke the rule. Behind everything is an eternal flow of quiet, smooth life. And wherever it becomes choppy, it's because of something we do. Now, we may say that we like that kind of variety. We'd rather make a few mistakes because it's interesting. But unfortunately, these interesting mistakes gradually undermine character. We cannot tolerate them. But the answer, of course, is to find something that is more interesting, something that is more happy than the mistakes that we have been depending upon for variety. It is not necessary for the individual to become angry simply because he possesses the potential of anger. It is perfectly possible to use this energy better. And fate and fortune, and to that matter, compensation, punishment, all are related to the use and abuse of the divine energy upon which all things depend. The moment we abuse life, life becomes unhappy. It becomes unpleasant. Not because life itself is pointing a finger at us, not because some evil spirit is causing us troubles, but because inherent in life is a power. And this power, if frustrated or misused or abused, will turn upon us and will gradually continue to turn upon us until at last we are forced into line with the integrities. One way, of course, to help to get the thing into a little better condition is to make sure that every day of our living, as far as possible, is in itself an interesting experience. We should have interests. We should have things to think about which keep our minds from negative attitudes. We should have a busy mental and emotional life that is constructive, that is doing things to add to our value as human beings. Art, music, all of these kinds of arts help to ennoble emotions and help to take us away from allowing emotions to simply stew inside of ourselves until they break out as a temper fit. All of the creative things of life are available to us because law is not only a preserver of all things, but it is the creator of all things. The universal law is creative. It is eternal in its unfoldment. And it is constantly so structured that it will reveal more and more of itself to those who make proper use of its resources. So it's a very good idea for the individual to be economical about things. We can't help but feel that there's a great deal of wastefulness in modern living. Most of the things that we do for pleasure cannot be justified. They mean absolutely nothing. They add to nothing. Many of them are very expensive, and then when they're all through, there's not much left but a headache. So therefore, one of the important things and that will help us to live properly is to control and direct activities. We can do things for less money, probably, that are far more interesting than many of the so-called pleasures which we now indulge, often excessively. Everything that works together for life and for value gradually builds up a tremendous sense of worthwhileness, a sense of doing something that is of significance to other people and of value to ourselves. So the retrospective exercise is a very good exercise for those who want to get into a little closer relationship with themselves. On the other hand, also, you have a form of concentrative exercise that Pythagoras also advocated. He and his disciples went out at dawn and offered the day to the life which had created it. They planned the day with not a heavy burden of responsibilities, but with a sense of significance. They took into account all the things that we have to do with the day, and that we don't have all this time to do anything we want to. But one of the things that we must try to preserve is enough energy and time to make some useful contribution every day to something, to some value within ourselves. Perhaps we can make this contribution in the job itself where we work. Just a little more sincerity in the work. Just a little more willingness and desire to earn the paycheck. Just to be a little bit more careful and cautious and economical in the various functions of our daily life. A little more thoughtful of family, a little more thoughtful of all the problems that come along by planning the day in advance and planning it before occasions demand, and then stay with the plan and standing firm against occasions that disqualify it. Gradually, we gain control over what we're going to do next, rather than trying to figure out how to get over what we've already done. So little by little, we gain a homogeneity, an integrity, a consistency, and a onefulness, a purposed life. Now, absolutely no one can be really happy who is bored. And nearly everyone is bored who isn't doing something useful. Boredom is nearly always associated with excess and corruptions of one kind or another. We try to do something to forget the fact that we're not doing anything. So in these things, you start looking inside yourself, and you try to measure out and say, I have an allotment. I have so much energy every day. I pay for this energy by the fact that I use it, and as I use it, I live in a limited amount of time. Therefore, I can only use this particular form of energy in this particular way while I am embodied in this world. Therefore, I want to make the most of this energy. I want it to help to build a better world. I want to find the pleasure in myself that comes from being useful rather than ornamental. I want to do things that make meaning. And also, I do not want to support extravagance. I do not want to dissipate or do these things which have no value to the life within us. Perhaps one of the simplest ways the old Christian mystic always used the symbol of Christ knocking at the door. This universal power in us, we can term the only begotten of the Father. It is the life itself. And it has a force that is forever knocking at our door. It is knocking through the medium of the heart and through the love and thoughtfulness and wisdom that comes from dedication to principles. And every day we live, this divine power is seeking to come through us. It wants to express itself in the creature which it has fashioned, for man is the noblest and most completely integrated form of life that we know. Man has the greatest potential. He has the greatest power to be, to do, to use the divine energies. He can actually help to restore the world which his ancestors destroyed. He can bring about now the conditions which will advance the destiny of descendants and help to leave a better world behind him. But between him and this achievement is always the arrogance, the ambition, and the self-centeredness, the selfishness that comes from his desperate effort to become important in the material world. We should have learned before this that it doesn't make any difference whether you're the most humble person in all the world or whether you are one of the world's great dictators. You're going to go to sleep in the same earth. Therefore, this idea of trying to own the world is a fallacy, for no one can own more than the amount it takes for his own body. And the rest is ambition, arrogance, and superstition. So we try to do something as we go along to release and venerate this life in ourselves. We want to think of our bodies as temples, as sanctuaries of a divine power. Whether we're rich or poor, whether the humblest of all native, primitive people, or the most highly evolved that we can imagine, we are all living houses of worship for the life that is within us. And in this life, in this temple, is the heart, which is the high altar. And here it is that the divine spirit abides with us. Our body is a living house of a living God. It is a place of worship. It is a place to dedicate to life. And each one, in the course of time, through the maturing of his own inner life, becomes an apostle of the life in the heart. He receives ordination, and every human being is potentially a minister of the Lord, a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, Prince of Salem. Every part of us is finally going to become a servant dedicated to the eternal in ourselves. Until this happens, problems will not end. Until this happens, the values of our lives will be uncertain. But it is very important to begin to think about it and try little by little to live according to this eternal power rather than to live according to the temporal attitudes and opinions of our own natures. It is very, very valuable to even make a little start and say to ourselves, today I will not waste that time again. Today I will not become an alcoholic. Today I will not increase my miseries and sufferings through perversities of mind, emotion, or body. I will not worry over that which cannot be changed. I will endure with patience that which is necessary. And I will find in the end that by accepting these problems rather than fighting them, I come through the end of the day with much more energy that can be devoted to better things. After all, this is really, in a sense, the mystery of the Eucharist. This is the mystery of the Last Supper. For this divine energy feeds us all. It is the source of every moment of our existence. It is not only the energy in ourselves that feeds us. We are also fed by the energy in other things that sacrifice themselves for our good. The energy in the wheat, in the flour, in all the different fruits and vegetables. The energies in all things become part of a power to restore our own material existence. And this vitality that we talk about with vitamins and all that, this is simply the same divine energy on a lower level of function. That part of energy which is completely related to body is understood in the form of nutrition. It prevents us from losing our lives for lack of food. And the alchemy of digestion and transformation within ourselves is nature's supreme mystery as far as physical matters are concerned. And therefore we have a kind of Eucharist here. One energy feeding all things. One life living in all things. And one life dedicating all these other lives, like the disciples at the Eucharist, to go forth and spread the gospel. To go and heal the sick. And comfort the sorrowful, and all these different things, and raise the dead. And in raising the dead, raise the individual who is completely locked in his materialism, for though he may be walking around, he is still dead. He is dead until life lifts him up into purpose. Until he has a purpose, he is not alive. And that one purpose must never be self-interest. Because that makes him more and more a kind of antichrist. It makes him more and more away from the great flow of life. We are all living by the shores of the river of life, and we are all dependent upon it. And the answer to it is that this river of life is our God. It is the spirit of all things in the innermost and the furthermost. It is the spirit in the tiniest mote floating in the sunbeam. It is the spirit in the vast galaxy which exists in space. All these things are moved by one energy, one life. And all these things survive because they obey the laws of that energy. And man, as Aquinas has pointed out, having a certain limited ability to function according to his own mind, determinism, he is capable of the mistaken decision. Because he has the right to choose, he may choose that which is best or that which is not best. But by the choice, he is disciplined. The reason man must make a choice himself is because he is not a creature that is a slave to anything. His final enlightenment comes through self-determination. By choosing that which is right, he becomes right. And by using and by becoming right, he uses the energies of space to preserve that which is right for himself and others. Now we are in the shadow of very heavy times at this moment, and they're very discouraging to many people. But we have to realize that this great life, which is moving through everything, has its own rules and can never fail. Ultimately, this life will bring all things home to itself again. It will prove out over infinities of time that the lessons that are necessary must be accepted. But by accepting the lessons, either by choice or necessity, we are growing toward that which is our own inevitable destiny, the destiny to fulfill the divine plan, the destiny to realize that we too are divine beings capable of determining right and wrong, capable of living according to law or according to the bodily pressures of environment. We can win the fight, but we can win a little every day. And every day when we make the smallest victory, there will be a little more of happiness and a little less of pain. Every day, one step forward, even a small decision, will strengthen us for another one tomorrow. And gradually, these right decisions will bring us enlightenment and companionship in the spiritual adventure of existence. These are the things that are important, and we hope that everyone will give a little special thought to them in his own way. Well, I guess that's all we can do right now, but I've got a couple of announcements to make that I think are important. This afternoon, we are having a memorial service at 1 o'clock for Leon Edwin Case. He has been with our organization for many, many years, and has been a very fine and wonderful person, and was one of the founders, apparently, of a group here of Foot Reflexology Awareness Association. And he has quite a group around him, or had it, and was a great inspiration to many people, and a very good friend of ours. So at 1 o'clock this afternoon, there will be a memorial service for Mr. Case here, and the members of the Foot Reflexology Association are providing the refreshments, so that today we will not have our refreshments. They all will be by courtesy of this organization in memory of Mr. Case. But it means, however, that you will have to make a great decision of integrity and unselfishness, because you will have to wait for the refreshments until after the memorial service is over. Thank you very much.